The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. Today, we have Michael Shermer and Philip Goff on the podcast. Michael is the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, and a presidential fellow at Chapman University, where he teaches Skepticism 101. He is the author of New York Times bestsellers Why People Believe Weird Things, The Believing Brain, and Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. Goff is an associate professor in philosophy at Central European University in Budapest. His main research focus is trying to explain how the brain produces consciousness. His first book, which was published by Oxford University Press, is called Consciousness and Fundamental Reality. Goff is currently working on a book on consciousness aimed at a general audience. Guy, it's so great to chat with you today.
All right.
Let's nice get to into be it.
You know,
thanks
this
for
is,
having us.
Yeah, this is not some light topics here, you know? but hopefully we'll have solved some of the deepest mysteries of humanity.
Absolutely.
Well, not just humanity. It's deepest mysteries of the universe today. So let's start off by giving a little context for this chat. Michael, you wrote an article for Scientific American called Will Science Ever Solve the Mysteries of Consciousness, Free Will, and God? And in that article, you contended that not only consciousness, but also free will and God are these sort of final mysteries. Can you explain a little bit what counts, like what criteria, you know, does it count to be a final mystery?
Yeah. So, but just by way of background, so it's a monthly, one of my monthly columns. So I've done over 200 of these, and every month I got to come up with something new. You know, I can't just debunk astrology every month in tarot card readers. That gets old pretty quick. So I've had in my head a long time this idea of the Mysterians back when I met Martin Gardner. In the late 80s, he called himself a Mysterian. I was like, what's a Mysterian? So as he articulated it, there's certain things that science could never prove or even really test because they're conceptual problems that are bounded by language. And he put God and free will in that category. And Martin, you know, he was the longtime columnist in Scientific American before me for 25 years. And he's really one of the founders of the modern skeptical movement, which is generally also associated with atheism, and yet he was a theist, or he called himself a fideist in James's pragmatism. And that, as James explained it, there's certain issues where if you can't prove it one way or the other, like God or free will, it's okay to just go ahead and make the leap for whatever works for you. So Martin would argue, for example, I think the atheists have slightly better arguments than the theists do. But, you know, we can't determine it one way or the other. So I choose to believe in God because it works for me. I'm not trying to claim anything. I can't prove it. I'm just saying that's what I believe at full, you know, full stop. Anyway, so I've had that in the back of my mind for a long time. So when I wrote this column, I thought, yeah, okay. So, you know, consciousness is famously the hard problem. And Steven Pinker had just written about this, and I just read, you know, his new book, Enlightenment Now, where he talks about the hard problem of consciousness as a conceptual problem, not a scientific problem. That is, but here we have to define specifically what we mean by the hard problem, because it's a little more complex than I made it out to be in my column. That is, what it feels like to be something, or what it is to be something. And now I know it's more complex than that, but, you know, the problem of other minds, like, I can't know what it's like to be you. My little homunculus in my head can't leap over into yours to see what you're like on the screen of your mind. You know, this is not how it works. So that could never be solved by science, what it feels like to be something else. I can only know, you know, in an experiential way, what it feels like to be me, and that's it. I can imagine what it's like to be you through mind reading, or I can imagine what it's like to be a bat, you know, with echolocation or something, by getting in a closet and talking to the wall and see, I can feel it bouncing off, or something like that. But that doesn't really mean I know what it's like to be a bat. Anyway, so that's why I threw that one in there. And then,
Michael, hold on a second. Before you go through all of them, I want to just back up. I just wanted you to provide the context, and then we'll go into each one individually.
Yeah.
As a package. And before we go into them, I did want to step back a moment and ask you both a question about argumentation and reasoning as the route to truth. Do you both think that is the ultimate route to truth, or even the only route to truth? I think that's an important discussion to have when we have this sort of discussion.
Absolutely. I mean, if there is another route to truth, it's not one I know about. I mean,
well, what about experiential? Experience. Surely you have
experience. Yeah. I guess my starting point is there are three sources of information about the world. One, perhaps the most familiar, is experiments and observation. You know, the scientific method. But I think we have another source of information about the world, namely the reality of consciousness, the immediate awareness of one's own conscious experience. So, you know, even if we had a theory, for example, that could account for all the data of observation and experiments, you know, the grand unified theory, but it couldn't account for the reality of consciousness, I think that would be thereby falsified, because we know that consciousness exists from our own case, from nothing is more evident than the realities of our feelings and experiences. So I'd say that they're the two main sources of data. And, you know, so some people think of the scientific method as, well, we just do observation experiments. In my view, we need to be a bit more expansive. We need to take what we know about the world from observation and experiments, but also the reality of consciousness as we immediately know it, and somehow find a way of putting the two together. And that's notoriously very difficult to do. But that, you know, I think that's how I see the project. And of course, the third source is reasoning, logic, the law of non-contradiction, mathematical logical reasoning. So those three things, I think, would be in my
view. That's a perfect articulation. I mean, I would agree that a public exchange of ideas is really the only way to get out of our own heads. So, for example, by way of background, I have an invitation to go to Costa Rica to spend
Are
5 days doing ayahuasca. Well, I don't even know if I want to do this, because apparently you have to puke your guts out for several hours a day to get the full experience.
I should have let you finish your sentence.
But the invitation comes from a fellow named Graham Hancock, who is sort of what we would skeptics call one of these alternative archaeologists. You know, he thinks the pyramids were built by these advanced civilization that lived 20,000 years ago and so on. But anyway, he's kind of into a spiritual type of truth, and that he knows for sure that this other spiritual world exists. It's another dimension or something. And the way to access it through the doors of perception, as it were, is through ayahuasca. And then if only I would do this, then I would know his truth about this spirit world. And the problem with that, in addition to the not wanting to puke for several hours a day while I get to this other world, is that, let's say I do that and I suddenly return and say, I was wrong. There is this other world. I'm not a materialist anymore. I'm now a dualist or whatever. And I write a column in Scientific American saying, I've discovered this new truth. And what I point to for you, instead of a data set, experiment or something, I point to you the ayahuasca and say, here, you drink the tea and you'll see it yourself. And I don't think that can get us out of our heads. I'm just putting my truth into your head through this artificial way of creating this other reality. And it's still not clear, you know, whether it's just all in the head or there is some other place to go. So at some point we have to get out of our heads, and in a public way, you or anybody can see what I'm pointing to. And if you can't do that, then I think we're not doing science.
Look, I want to thank you both for giving that really elucidating response to my question. But I do have a question in response to that, Michael, because I wonder, like, what if the ultimate truth of reality happens to be something that is incomprehensible to humans or does not coincide with your rational facilities? So what if, like, okay, let's say you die someday. Well, you will die someday. But say sorry to break the news to you. When that happens, what if you discover, you know, there is something, it's nothing that you ever could have imagined or predicted based on the limited cognitive faculties that you evolved or not evolved. I guess we'll discuss God in a second. But do you see what I'm saying? What I'm saying is, like, how do you, like, why are you so sure that, like, your rationality trumps the experience?
I'm not sure. And it's entirely possible that I could wake up in some other place after my death. That's okay. I'm fine. I'm open to that possibility. But that doesn't mean I can state in any assertive way that this could be true. I just don't know. Gotcha. So in skepticism, the default position is the null hypothesis. What you just described is we assume is not true until proven otherwise. Now, so the problem here is, let's say this happens and I wake up in this other place. How can I come back and communicate with you or anyone that, you know, I've been to the other side and I've seen it and it's great. And of course, this is what people who have near-death experiences tell us. And yet, here's the problem of external validation. Yes, I'm not all. The problem of external validation, again, I can't tell the difference between, this is what I describe in my book, Heavens on Earth, between, say, Eben Alexander's passages in his book, Proof of Heaven, of this trip he took to heaven, and then the opening pages of Sam Harris's book, Waking Up, in which he talks about this trip he took on, I think it was ecstasy or MDMA. To me, the narrative sounds the same. One took drugs, one had, you know, a brain experience while in a coma, and the narratives sound the same to me. And the same thing with reading Oliver Sacks's books. In his memoir, he talks about dropping acid in the 60s and the fantastic trips he took. And to me, they all sound the same. So how can we validate, get out of our heads and get some external validation, whether it's all just in our heads or some of them are actually real?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of broadly in agreement with what Michael's saying with reference to phenomena outside of the mind. I'm a little bit hesitant about applying this to consciousness. I mean, to go back to the problem of consciousness, I mean, I kind of agreed with pretty much a lot of the problem as Michael articulated it. I mean, I phrase it slightly differently. So the core of the problem of consciousness for me is that physical science works with a purely quantitative vocabulary, whereas consciousness is an essentially qualitative phenomenon, just in the sense that it involves qualities. If you think about the redness of a red experience or the smell of coffee or the taste of a lemon, you can't capture these kind of qualities in the quantitative language of physical science. And in fact, this was well understood by the founder of physical science, Galileo. Right? So Galileo only ever intended physical science as a partial account of reality. He hoped that it could capture the quantitative mathematical features of reality, but he never dreamt that it could capture the qualities of consciousness, which he believed resided in the soul. So I think, you know, physical science, because of the limits of its vocabulary, can never give us a complete account of consciousness. It can never capture these subjective qualities. However, and this is, I don't know, maybe where I start to part company with Michael, my starting point is we know that consciousness is a real phenomenon, right? Each of us, it is not publicly accessible. You can't look inside my head and see my feelings and my pain, but each of us knows, you know, it's uncontroversial. Each of us knows that it's real. So it has to be integrated into our scientific picture of the world somehow. Now, if we agree if physical science is not up to that task and it was never designed for that task, I think we need to look to other paradigms of scientific explanation. So I think maybe we'd part company at that point.
So you don't call yourself a mysterian regarding consciousness?
No, I'm open to that. I take mysterianism seriously as a theoretical possibility. I mean, if you think we've evolved through natural selection, then, you know, it might not be surprising if we don't have access to all of, you know, nature's mysteries. In fact, you know, if we've evolved to survive rather than do science, you might think it's surprising that we can do as well as we can. But I guess I'm inclined to think, you know, why would you go for mystery if there are other possibilities? So I'm inclined to think there are other scientific paradigms on the table that can potentially give us a complete account, an intelligible account of consciousness. So I'm a proponent of the view known as panpsychism, as an alternative scientific paradigm for explaining consciousness. So I guess my point is give that a go, and if that doesn't work out, I guess I think there are good reasons to think physical science can never give us a complete account of the mind, as you know, it's never been what it's designed to do. But I think there are other non-physicalist modes of scientific paradigms. Try them out.
Yeah.
If nothing works, then we can be Mysterians. I guess that's...
Phil, can you please explain to our listening audience what panpsychism is?
Sure. So I like to introduce as follows. I think, you know, we've been trying for many decades now to explain consciousness in terms of utterly non-conscious processes in the brain, and we've made very little progress on that, at least on the central problem of consciousness. So the panpsychist proposes an alternative research program. Rather than trying to explain consciousness in terms of non-consciousness, we try to explain complex human and animal consciousness in terms of simpler forms of consciousness that are then postulated to exist as basic aspects of matter. So that's the basic research program.
Does that relate to Tononi's work, or was it Giulio Tononi? Giulio Tononi.
Yeah, I mean, so panpsychism, you know, it sounds a bit wacky, but I mean, when I first started applying for jobs like 12 years ago, and people told me, people who had a lot of, you know, respect, who told me to keep panpsychism secret, because, you know,
really?
it's not very credible. But in the last 5 or 10 years, you know, in academic philosophy, this has gone from being a position that's kind of laughed at to be, you know, to a lot of philosophers thinking it is perhaps our best hope for an intelligible solution to the problem of consciousness. Largely because, I mean, the influence of the rediscovery of some very important work in the 1920s by the philosopher Bertrand Russell and the scientist Arthur Eddington that has sort of been rediscovered and causing a lot of interest in academic philosophy. A lot of my work is bringing together the literature there. But also there's this in neuroscience, one of the leading neuroscientific theories of consciousness, integrated information theory, does have panpsychist implications, at least in the sense that it predicts that consciousness is more widespread than we ordinarily take it to be. And it also has, arguably, you know, a lot of empirical confirmation.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of empirical confirmation in terms of the non-hard problem, just in terms of the neurocorrelates view, in
yes,
the sense that, like, you know, I mean, it's interesting. What have we learned from the neuroscience? Well, for one, it's interesting that the cerebellum doesn't really play much of a role in consciousness, and it's really kind of our higher order cerebral cortex functions. And the one network that seems to be particularly associated with consciousness, my colleague Daniel Bohr has written a book on this called The Ravenous Brain. I don't know if you read it, linking the frontal parietal brain network to consciousness, and the frontal parietal brain network is associated with intelligence, general intelligence, you know, like IQ tests, with concentration, but really integration, you know, like really the ability to integrate all the area. It's like the executive area, although there's no specific area, like, you know, it's no homunculus, but, you know, it seems to be able to serve a coordination function. So there does seem to be something there with integration.
Sure.
Yeah. Michael, I wanted to ask your thoughts, you know, so we make sure we include you in this conversation. Just putting that out there, do you think that, like, even if we have a complete understanding of how consciousness arises from an emergent property of integration, is that going to satisfy you from a final perspective?
Well, it depends what problem we're trying to solve. That would be the so-called easy problem, which doesn't really seem easy at all. But the fact that someone
easier,
like Christoph Koch, my friend Christoph Koch, who I know well and have followed for the last 25 years, you know, he seems to be working toward really a deeper understanding of the neural correlates of consciousness. I do note that recently he's embraced this panpsychism idea through Tononi's ITT. Okay, so that gets my attention. So it just depends on, you know, if that research paradigm is successful, what problem is that solving? If it solves this problem of not what it's like to be something, this qualitative experience, to me, that just seems like a conceptual problem, not a scientific one. But if it's, you know, what are the neural correlates of consciousness? How does consciousness come online or something like that as brains become larger and more complex, then that seems completely doable. And so, for example, if we came back 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now, and looked at what neuroscientists were doing, you know, it could be entirely be, you know, oh, we've completely solved that problem. Would they be able to say, oh, the mind-body problem, oh, yeah, that's we solved that 300 years ago. That's no problem, and here's the answer. That's possible. You know, it could be we're just approaching it the wrong way, or But what the Mysterians say is that the limitation is in our conception, language, the size of our brain, how our brains are structured. And that if we encountered an ET from wherever, Vega or something, and they had a brain, you know, 10 times the size of ours, that, you know, it could be, you know, the mind-body problem is no problem at all. They completely figured that out. And so, you know, by Mysterian, we just mean, you know, for our brains at this moment, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a good question, Michael, is, you know, what are we trying to do here? What is the question? I mean, the way I think about it is what we want is that an intelligible explanation of how consciousness fits into our scientific story. We know it's real. We know it's real. So it must fit in somehow. And so the question is, how does it fit in? I think there are, you know, what most people think, oh, the only scientific way to do it is to account for it in terms of physical science, in terms of, you know, we just keep doing neuroscience. I mean, so there's this standard line people say, you know, okay, the hard problem is hard, but if you look at the great success of physical science and explaining more and more of our universe, then, you know, that ought to give us confidence that one day crack the problem of consciousness. If we just carry on with kind of standard neuroscience. But I've got a slightly different take on the history of science. You know, I argue in my book that the reason physical science has done so well is because Galileo kicks things off by taking consciousness outside of the domain of scientific inquiry. And he thereby gives physical scientists a more manageable task, right? Roughly the task of constructing mathematical models for predicting the behavior of matter. And that project has gone really well. And it provides really useful information, right? If you can predict with great accuracy how matter behaves, then you can manipulate the world and have a wonderful technology. So that's gone really well, but it was never designed to account for the subjective qualities in our immediate awareness. It was designed to predict behavior. And so when I just don't buy at all these arguments, oh, it's done really well at predicting behavior, so it's going to explain consciousness. It was never designed to do that. I think if Galileo was to time travel to the present day and hear about this hard problem of consciousness, he'd say, you know, of course you can't give a physical account of consciousness. I designed physical science to predict behavior for quantities, not qualities. So I think, you know, we're going through a phase of history where we're sort of so blown away by the success of physical science that we've forgotten that it was always intended as a limited project of predicting behavior.
Well, hold on a second, because like there's a whole wide swath of psychologists that primarily rely on the qualitative method of analysis. Let's not like hate on them.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
There's insight and understanding that can be had, even descriptive, you know, descriptive understanding through fully understanding the experience of an individual. Well, clinical could be one example, but you know, there's a lot of humanistic psychologists who, well, a lot of them are clinicians, but some of them aren't. Where, and just others, even working in other fields like social work, etc. There are some social science, like sociology. Some of them consider themselves social scientists, you know, where they try to extrapolate from a deep qualitative analysis of something. And there are actually quantitative methods that help you like code and, you know, understand patterns in qualitative data.
You're completely right. I've oversimplified. One always has to sort of overgeneralize to get the general picture out, and then you fine-tune the details. I think what I mean by physical science, I'm not talking about science. I'm talking about a very specific understanding of physical science, that aspect that has a purely quantitative vocabulary. I mean, it's most exemplified in physics, which is basically mathematics and maybe some causal notions. I think neuroscience is not too far away from that. So I suppose what my view is you cannot fully account for the qualities of consciousness in that kind of vocabulary. But of course, I mean, there are sciences that, you know, have their data asking people what they're feeling or whatever.
Right.
To that extent, the data is conscious. Psychology, certainly. But my point is, look, there's a lot of people for many decades now, the dominant view is still, no, we've just got to keep doing neuroscience and we'll explain consciousness in a purely quantitative language of neuroscience. I think that project, we've never got anywhere with it. It's not what physical science was designed for. And I think there are just conceptual problems with it. So but that doesn't mean we can't account for consciousness scientifically. Mm. And I think that what the hope of the panpsychist research program that's very much in sway now is that we can at some point give an intelligible account of human and animal consciousness in terms of more basic forms of consciousness that are then postulated to exist as basic constituents of matter. At least give that a go,
Yeah, a couple points on this. When I mentioned clinicians here, I was thinking of the recovered memory movement. And what became clear there was the difference between experimental psychologists and clinical psychologists. And so if you're a clinician, you have a patient, a client, they're trying to explain, you know, why he or she feels depressed or is overweight, can't sleep, whatever the symptoms are that they're there for. And they identify something in their past. I think, you know, I was molested as a child. Now, pretty soon that becomes a truth for them in their head. That is the explanation for my malaise. And for the clinician is not there to determine what really happened. It's just, that's the truth for my client. And if I get results and they feel less depressed, then I'm successful. But at some point, the problem steps out of the clinician's room when, say, the person being accused of being the molester is arrested and charged with a crime. And that's what happened in the 90s. And that caused a lot of people great harm. And so we saw the difference there. It's not okay to just say it's my truth, full stop, when it has consequences for other people's realities. Okay, so that's one point. Second point, back on the physical sciences and Galileo. Now, if the original Mysterians, Colin McGinn and Noam Chomsky, in particular, it's a great video lecture he has at MIT where he's talking about, he starts it at Newton, and that Newton's identification of gravity and his statement, I feign no hypotheses. In other words, what is gravity? I don't know. It's kind of an occult thing. And my mathematics is just telling us what planets do and objects do when they're near each other and their mass and so on. But if you ask me, but what is it? I don't know what it is. Yeah. You know, gravity is the tendency for objects to attract one another. Well, why do objects attract one another? Because of gravity. Well, this is a tautology. So now we're getting, Philip, at the problem you identified. It's from a quantitative to a qualitative. Yeah, but what is it? Now, you know, someone like Kip Thorne at Caltech, who deals with, you know, general relativity and so on, he'll tell you it has something to do with time, and he goes into Einstein and equations and so on. I'm not sure I really understand it. But that almost starts to shift into that, well, it does, into that sort of qualitative features of the natural world that maybe the kind of science we've been doing is not equipped to fully understand with the words that we use.
Michael, I really appreciate those two points, and I definitely want to hear what Philip has to say to that. Just really quickly, I was, you know, when I was making my point, and I wasn't necessarily thinking about clinicians, an example that might be helpful here, I was thinking of like Herb Simon and Newell, like when they first kind of started this cognitive revolution. I mean, they used cognitive modeling techniques or think aloud protocols where they asked large groups of participants to think aloud while they were solving a problem, for instance. And we learned a lot about the fundamental principles of cognition through that sort of subjective, one could say a more subjective approach. So I was more thinking about that along those kind of lines.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in back in the 19th century, Alfred Russell Wallace broke with Darwin on this subject. He was the subject of my doctoral dissertation. I wrote a biography of him. And he argued, if natural selection is definitely true, but why would it create brains so large and so capable of experiencing things like mathematics, aesthetic appreciation, art, music, and so on? What's the purpose of that? Why do you need that? I mean, having a chimp-sized brain is all you need for survival. Why do you need a brain four times that size? What would be the adaptive purpose of being able to function, of being able to do calculus, quantum physics, whatever that, not in his time, but any kind of mathematics or aesthetic appreciation? And Wallace carried that line of reasoning out where he concluded there has to be some kind of higher intelligence that put that spark in there. And Darwin said, no, we're not going that far. And this is a long process. As soon as you introduce natural selection in the formula, it's like, yeah, why would we be able to do this? This is an interesting problem.
And why are we the only ones to do it to this extent? Yeah.
Can I link back to some of the Chomsky stuff Michael was saying about that?
Oh, yeah.
I think this really connects to the influence of Russell and Eddington from the 1920s, which is recently been rediscovered in academic philosophy, which is, you know, causing a great deal of interest for this panpsychist model. So their starting point is very closely related to the Chomsky point there, that so in the public mind, physics is giving us this complete description of reality. But what Russell and Eddington realize is that it becomes apparent upon reflection that physical science is confined to telling us what matter does. You know, if you think about what physics tells us about an electron, tells us it has mass and charge. And these characteristics are characterized completely behavioristically. You know, charge is characterized in terms of attraction, repulsion. Mass is characterized in terms of gravitational attraction and resistance to acceleration. So physics tells us what the electron does, how it behaves. It tells us nothing about what philosophers like to call the intrinsic nature of the electron, how the electron is in and of itself. So this is sometimes called the problem of intrinsic natures. You know, like the physical science tells us nothing about the intrinsic nature of matter. It tells us great information about how it behaves, but it doesn't tell us how it is in and of itself. So there's this sort of huge hole in our scientific picture of the universe. Now, the genius of Russell and Eddington, though, and this is where it becomes non-Mysterian or sort of moves beyond Mysterianism, they said, well, look, their genius was to relate that problem to the problem of consciousness. Right? The problem of consciousness is we're looking for this place for consciousness. We know it exists. Where can we put it? The problem of intrinsic nature says we don't know the intrinsic nature of matter. So Russell and Eddington said, well, put consciousness in the hole. We've got this hole. We need to find a place for consciousness. Put consciousness in the hole. So the idea is there's just matter, right? That's all there is, just matter, nothing supernatural. Physical science tells us what it does, how it behaves, but its intrinsic nature is constituted of forms of consciousness. So this gives us a beautiful, simple, parsimonious way of integrating consciousness into our scientific picture of the world. And it gives us a way of doing that avoids the problems of materialism on the one hand, the problems of dualism on the other. So that's the kind of research program, the kind of general picture of how consciousness fits in that is becoming attractive to a lot of philosophers and some neuroscientists now. And yeah, don't need to be Mysterians. We can be Russell Eddington panpsychists.
So let's transition to free will from that point.
Okay.
And let's see if we can apply that same logic to free will and God as well. We'll see. And Michael, you know, if you had any points you want to respond to that, maybe you could fold it into the free will discussion.
That's okay. We can move on.
Great. Yeah. So you write in your article that we live in a deterministic universe and still we act as though we have free will. Could you elaborate a little bit more, Michael, what you meant by that?
Yeah, so it's kind of tease apart the different elements of this. You can say free will is an illusion, but it's a great illusion. It works. It's a useful fiction, as the French philosopher Hans Weiner called it. It certainly feels like I have free will. I'm making choices. That's what it seems like intuitively. But that would still be the determinist position. I'm arguing along the lines of what Dan Denna argues in Freedom Evolves, that we are complex enough organisms that there are so many variables at work. And the fact that we are part of the causal net ourselves by being aware of these vectors that are influencing us and pushing us around to the point where we can affect them back, we can push back. And so even though it's all determined, we live in a determined universe, being part of the causal net and being aware and self-aware of the causal variables influencing us, we can do something about it. And out of that emerges something like volition or choice or whatever word you want to use. And part of the problem here, again, is language. You know, I start using active verbs and I hear determinists using active verbs all the time as if, you know, they're making these choices because that's what it feels like. And I think it's okay to do that because that isn't, in essence, what we're doing. So the example I use, say, I'm aware that in the late afternoon, I'm going to get a craving for chocolate chip cookies. So ahead of time, make sure I don't have any in the house. I'm not going to, you know, be going to the store at that time or the shop that has cookies or something. I'm aware of these influences on my behavior that, you know, future Shermer is going to do this. So current Shermer can affect the variables that I know that he knows is coming, or I, who, he, me.
It's tricky.
So something like that. But again, I think I put in the Mysterian category because we're delimited by the language we use, these words. If it's determined, how can you be free? Well, not really free. There's not libertarian free will. Just there's no homunculus. But even if there were, you know, then there'd have to be a mini-me inside me, and then a mini-me, mini-mini-me inside mini-me inside me, and so on. And that doesn't solve the problem either. So to me, it's just one of these conceptual head scratchers. The fact that, now I'm not a philosopher, so from an outsider, to me, it seems like a problem like this that's been talked about for 2,500 years, and there's no consensus, like there's no climate consensus committee for free will that says, yeah, 97% of philosophers agree that compatibilism is true or determinism is true or whatever. I've even seen these surveys that I cite, that big one that David Chalmers did in 2009 of, you know, 3,600 professional philosophers, graduate students, professors, and so on. And compatibilist position was 59% embraced the compatibilist position. And then the next category was determinist, and the lowest one was libertarian free will. So to me, that tells us, I mean, we don't do this by vote, but on the other hand, it does give us a clue that there's something else going on here. When the smartest people who know the most about a subject can't agree even remotely, there's no general consensus like there isn't, say, climate, then there's something else wrong with the language or the concept itself that's not going to get us there.
I want to thank you for posing that problem so articulately. You brought this mini-me idea, and what if you're not thinking about that in the right way? So it seems like the brain is like something that does seem to be consensus in the field of cognitive neuroscience is that the brain is hierarchically organized in a sense. So that they're not all mini yous. Maybe I would, I just want to put out there and then let's discuss this. Not, you know, we are comprised of multiple subcomponents, but there are some, like we talked about earlier, the prefrontal parietal brain network that is higher level coordination. So there is perhaps gives you more free will than lower order ones. Maybe we can actually rank in a hierarchy, like which subcomponents are more allows us more degrees of freedom than others. I'm just putting this out there and want to see what you guys think of that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, I guess what you're both doing is trying to make sense of compatibilist notions of free will. And maybe we should get clear on this distinction. I mean, actually, one thing I'd like to say from the start, I think this problem, to my mind, is very different from the problem of consciousness in the sense that I think, as I've said many times, I think we know for certain consciousness is real. So there's a genuine phenomenon there that we have to account for somehow. But I don't think we have that same kind of certainty with free will, right? It certainly seems as though we're free. You know, it seems as though certain of my decisions are completely up to me, you know, in the sense that I'm not compelled to act by prior causes. But that could be an illusion, right? It could be that it feels as though I'm free, but I'm not. However, I'm personally not persuaded, and this is, as Michael points out, I'm in the minority among philosophers. I'm personally not persuaded by any of the scientific or philosophical arguments against free will or for determinism. And so I'm a tentative believer, not only in free will, but in free will of the particularly strong libertarian kind. So the idea is here, the idea here is that certain of my choices are completely up to me in the sense that they're not determined by prior causes. I don't think there is, I've never seen the scientific case that the brain is, I think just to finish this up, I think there are certain, in any philosophical paradigm, there are certain convictions that are defended on the basis of evidence. And then there are certain kind of dogmas that are just generally accepted as part of the zeitgeist. I think determinism is like that. I've never seen a peer-reviewed scientific paper proving that the brain is a deterministic machine. I mean, there's certainly no consensus among, there isn't a consensus in the research literature. Whereas Michael and Scott also seem to be saying this, you know, assuming the compatibilist says, okay, science has shown we're not free in the libertarian sense, but we can try and work out some kind of watered down notion of freedom. And I think that's what Dennett does, for example. But I'm still not persuaded. I'm open-minded, but I'm still not persuaded that there isn't evidence that I'm not free in the sense we ordinarily take ourselves to be. So yeah, that's my position on
I really appreciate
wow,
that.
Wow, you're the first professional philosopher I've met who embraces real free will.
Tentatively, right?
Tentatively. You're open to it.
Yeah. If there were scientific, if someone showed me, like you said, climate change is a great example. You know, I believe in climate change because there's a consensus in literature. If there emerged, if someone showed me a peer-reviewed scientific paper proving the brain is a deterministic mechanism, I'd give it up in a second. But I don't see that.
The determinist then would counter, well, but, all thoughts are just, neurons firing, just chemical swapping across synaptic gaps. It's a mechanical system. It's a physical system. It's a Galilean Newtonian clockwork system. What's your response to that? So in other words, your thoughts are just, they're just generating there. You have no idea why they're doing what they're doing.
I think this maybe gets back to the consciousness issue. So my view, my Russell Eddington panpsychist view is there's just the brain, right? But physical science doesn't tell us what the brain is. It just tells us what it does and what its parts do. My mind is at least part of the intrinsic nature of my brain. So yeah, my brain is the only stuff. There's nothing supernatural. There's no souls. My brain is the only thing doing stuff. But my conscious mind is part of the intrinsic nature of my brain. So I think they're consistent. I'm just not persuaded that there is any scientific evidence that the brain as a whole is a deterministic system. Yeah.
Well, this was Benjamin LeBay's, experiments where, some part of your brain is making this decision for you before your conscious part of your brain is even aware of it. Isn't that, that sounds like a deterministic.
Well, right.
That's consistent with the hierarchical organization of the brain, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So Libet's experiments are, you know, really interesting. So Libet showed, so these experiments where these are the classic experiments that are appealed to in this context. So he took, you know, a group of subjects and asked them to make a free choice under experimental conditions. And it was always something trivial like, you know, whether to press a button on the left rather than the right or something. And then he wanted to ascertain the time at which the free choice happened. So he got them looking at a clock on the wall and they had to note the time at which it happens. And at the same time, he has them hooked up to an EEG and he can, so he can measure the time at which the brain initiates the decision. So the shocking result was that the brain initiates the decision on average 300 milliseconds before the subject consciously recalls making it. So people say, you know, this is shows that free will is an illusion, that you know, the brain decides what we're going to do before we consciously decide. So I think these are fascinating experiments. I think the conclusions are grossly exaggerated. Yes. I mean, one problem that Daniel Dennett, in fact, points to is that there's a much more simple interpretation of the data, namely that we systematically get wrong the times of our decisions, at least in these highly artificial circumstances. You know, what these subjects were asked to do is make a decision and simultaneously note the time you made it. And, you know, maybe we can't do that. But can I just finally, sorry to talk too long, but just the broader point on the Libet stuff and similar experiments is that the free decisions, in inverted commas, that he focuses on are not the free choices that anyone cares about, right? They're just arbitrary things like pressing a button on the left rather than the right. Yeah. You know, what proponents of free will care about are rational decisions like, you know, whether to take a job, whether to get married, whether to betray your friend, these decisions where we freely choose from among rational considerations. And the Libet experiments have nothing to say about it. So at best, they show that the conscious mind can't, you know, instigate a completely random, meaningless action. But it doesn't show anything, you know, who cares about that? So yeah, so that's what I think of Libet.
And I think Roy Baumeister has done a good job showing we have this little wiggle room, at least, even when our subconscious may make a decision, then there's also like, you know, there's like subconscious decisions and conscious decisions, you know, like even though like all my computations have told me like this is the one for me to marry, there's still this like conscious decision I can say, well, despite how I feel about this and despite, you know, what my subconscious has computed for me, you know, like I'm going to continue dating, you know.
Yeah, Libet, in his final book before he died, he declared himself a compatibilist. He rejected hard determinism, even though his own research is cited by determinists. Although, as I point out in my book, The Moral Arc, that there's also free won't. Later experiments added elements where you could push another button at the last minute and change your mind and override the initial impulse. Like, ooh, I'm going to
really
push
like
A.
That.
But no, I'm going to push B. Nope, back to A. Oh, no, B. And so what's going on there? Or as I like to ask, say, what's the difference between us who are not drug addicts and the drug addict who just cannot control, or the alcoholic can't take the drink or whatever? Is that person just more determined than you and I are determined? And what would that mean to say more determined or less determined? So there's a scale there. Some kind of quantitative scale of determinism. In that case, that's not the right word.
Wow, Michael, you just opened up such a can of worms. If you really like, if our brains compute all the real deep implications of your point, that would be obviously be a conversation that would last days and months and years, probably a lifetime. But what if you bring in the genes into the picture here, right? Like, well, we know for a fact there some people have through heredity a more difficult time resisting certain temptations than others. I think that's a fair statement to say. It shouldn't be particularly controversial to say that.
Yep.
So it's easier for you to have, you know, like for one person, it might obviously like, I'm not going to get addicted. Like I don't have, you know, like that strong urge to do that. But so that, do they have more free will to do that than person B who might come from a long family of alcoholism?
Right. So, I mean, maybe these are not the right words. We're using the wrong language. You mentioned Roy Baumeister, you know, he and John Tierney had that great book, Willpower.
Yeah.
So he, you know, it's just chapter after chapter of what you can do about this. And here's what the research shows about how you can gain control over your thoughts. Well, what are you doing when you do that? You know, you can say, well, it's all determined. Yeah, but some part of me is jumping into the middle of the causal chain and saying, no, I'm going to move down the left path instead of the right path, because I'm aware if I go down the right path, I'm going to become an addict or a cigarette smoker or an alcoholic. And so I know if I do, I can move down the left path. Now, the determinist would say, yeah, but you didn't have a, you know, some particle that did something a billion years ago, you know, ultimately got into your neuron and made it fire this way instead of that. I don't know. But to me, it's still a kind of volitional action.
You know, but I feel like mechanicalistically, we can kind of understand that, you know, like the BA10, like you said, like, where is it? I'm like, I'd say like, basically it's the BA10. Like, and then of course the question is, well, what is instigating that? But genes do have some sort of blueprint for the extent to which these brain activations are going to be easily activated. You know, like psychopaths, when you scan their brains, there are these certain subcortical regions that are almost dark, you know, like they're just not activating by default at all. So I think it's interesting to think how genes, not deterministically, but probabilistically, influence whether or not you're going to go a lifetime with a lot easy default activations of certain brain areas that exert control in a top-down way on certain functions.
Okay, here's my final thought experiment to for the hardcore determinist. Okay, so the hardcore determinist is married, happily married, and goes to a conference and meets this attractive person, and they end up with a hookup, and the spouse finds out when they get home, and he said, "Well, now listen, see, honey, my thoughts come from where I know not where. My genes, you know, my neurons were firing, and, you know, I just really have no volitional choice in the matter. It's all determined." You know, could he even finish the argument before the hand comes across and slaps the face?
Sure.
You know, could you have done otherwise? Yeah, you could have done otherwise, and you better not do it again. Okay.
Well, so, yeah. I want to be very clear, Michael. Culpability is not the same as the, you know, explanation. Yeah.
Well, but the hardcore determinist would say you're not really culpable.
Oh,
but
well,
in
I'm
this
not
case,
a hardcore determinist.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd agree. I guess if I wasn't a libertarian, if I was persuaded that empirical is false, I'd be some kind of compatibilist rather than a hard determinist. And in either case, whether there's libertarian free will or not, for all the reasons you've both been saying, there's going to be a really complicated story here. You know, a difference between basic desires, what you want to do, and higher order desires, what you want to do. Yeah. It's quite attractive to characterize the addictive person in that way, that they want the cigarettes, but they don't want to want. And there's going to be some story we can tell there about something like freedom. So I think actually the libertarian and the compatibilist will have a lot in common, a lot in common. And there's going to be this kind of complicated story that can be agreed on.
Okay.
But I'm just not persuaded that I think we do think about many of our choices in the libertarian way. And I don't yet find any scientific reason to give that up
for tomorrow. In 15 minutes, do you think we can solve God, the existence of God?
Oh, yeah. Totally, no problem.
Absolutely.
Small topic. You're a panpsychist. What is it? Does that mean you're necessarily also a pantheist? Like, is
absolutely
that the corollary?
No.
Okay, good.
No, I mean, panpsychism is, you know, and this is the unfortunate thing that, you know, it has these unfortunate cultural associations with certain kind of new age thinking and stuff. But, you know, I think you should judge a view on its explanatory power rather than its cultural associations. And it's panpsychism is intended as a, you know, a cold-blooded best explanation of consciousness. It doesn't have any necessary connection to anything supernatural or theological.
Okay.
On the topic of God, you know, I mean, I don't see why. I guess I wasn't persuaded by Michael's that we should be Mysterians about God. So I don't see why God isn't the kind of thing we can more or less straightforwardly offer evidence for and against. So I'm actually agnostic because I think there's very powerful evidence against the existence of God. And I also think there's very powerful evidence for the existence of God. Mm. So I think the jury's kind of out there. But so at the moment, yeah. So,
In the Martin Gardner sense I mentioned of the arguments between theists and atheists, he said atheists have slightly better arguments, but only slightly. The theists have good arguments, like the design argument, for example.
Yeah, I guess I think the case against the familiar problem of evil, I think, is the existence of evil and suffering is very strong evidence against this of God. I don't think religious philosophers have ever come up with anywhere near plausible explanations for why a loving God would allow those things to happen. And I think this problem has become worse since our moral awareness has progressed. So we now, for example, think of animals' interest is morally significant. And so this raises the question, you know, why would a loving God choose to create life through a horrific process of natural selection? But in terms of the evidence, I mean, I am You're going to disagree with me now, Michael. I think there is force to the argument for God from the fine-tuning of, you know, this surprising discovery in the last 40 years, completely surprising that some of the numbers in basic physics are against improbable odds exactly as they need to be for life to be physically possible. So just to take one example from Martin Rees, the strong nuclear force is 0.007. If it had been 0.006 or less, we'd just have a universe of hydrogen. If it had been 0.008 or more, the hydrogen would have fused into heavy elements. In either case, we'd have absolutely no chemical complexity and therefore no life.
So God was a chemist?
Well, I think
is that what you're saying?
Like many scientists and philosophers, I think that this needs to be explained. But there seem to be two explanations. One is that God created the universe and set those numbers in order to make a universe where life is possible. Or the other explanation, the multiverse hypothesis, there are a huge, perhaps infinite number of universes, which between them exemplify a large range of these numbers so that it becomes statistically inevitable that you'll get one with the right laws for life. Now, you know, the atheists say, oh, well, it must be the multiverse. And the theists say, oh, well, it must be God. You know, to my mind, these both sound like pretty crazy hypotheses. And I don't think we're in a position, talking about things, you know, I don't think we're in a rational position to decide one way or the other. So yeah. I think the jury's out.
Settle. We're not going to settle this in the next 5 minutes, once and for all.
Maybe we will.
You are a Mysterian. Well, okay, a couple of things on that. Now, my physicist cosmologist friends tell me that the multiverse idea was not conceived as an explanation for the fine-tuning, that it is derived from the equations, predictions of equations are this, there should be multiple universes of various kinds, the quantum kind or just the cosmological kind. And it is not just a fallback position by desperate atheists to explain why there can't be a God. This is what theists argue. Oh, you guys, what's the difference between the multiverse and God? But second, Steven Weinberg makes this point, the Nobel laureate physicist, that, you know, we don't know enough to say that the fine tuning, you know, had to be this way or else, you know, it couldn't have come about. That we don't have a unified theory of physics that, unites the global general relativity and quantum physics, that there might be some underlying equations that then these fine-tuned numbers end up falling into place perfectly well. Totally understandable because of this underlying principles that we don't yet understand. So before we draw any conclusions one way or the other, you know, we need to wait on how that works out. Now, the reason I threw God into the Mysterian category, in part because of my numerous debates I've done over the years with theists, where they make these arguments like the fine-tuning argument, the cosmological argument, the first cause, prime mover, and all that, and, you know, I counter them. And at some point, or they go through prayers and miracles and the origins of consciousness, the origins of morality. When I counter all those arguments, I ask, you know, that there should be some way of measuring this deity and its actions in this world. And their ultimate fallback is God is outside of space and time. Okay, if God is not a natural being, then how would you know it exists? Because we're natural beings. You can't measure something that's non-natural. In that sense, there's no such thing as the supernatural, the paranormal. These are just words we use to describe things we understand. And so my counterexample is like, so my date, you know, there's this theory by Roger Penrose and Stuart Hameroff about consciousness derives or instantiates through these microtubules inside neurons. Anyway, they have this long, complex theory. Almost no neuroscientists accept it. But their idea is that, you know, these quantum effects happen in a warm environment like a brain in these microtubules. And when the wave functions collapse at a certain pattern of neural firing, it can leave my skull and go into your skull. So that this would explain mind reading, for example, or spooky action at a distance between minds. And okay, I don't believe any of this, but let's say this was true. And this would no longer make it ESP, paranormal, psychic power. It would just be a branch of quantum consciousness or something. It would just be a part of the natural world we didn't understand before, and now we do. So essentially, we're eliminating paranormal, supernatural explanations by incorporating them into the natural world. And so what we describe as God doing things, or the characteristics of God, to me, if it's true, then God would just be part of the natural world. It would just be like a super advanced extraterrestrial intelligence. The analogy is if, you know, if I show a Neanderthal an iPhone, you know, this would be like I'm God, or, you know, I have this device that's godlike. It's just like Clark's third law, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, or you could say God. So how would we know? And what do you mean by God? So therefore, it's a mysterion. Anyway, that's how I ended up at that conclusion.
Thank you for that, explaining why you got to that conclusion. You know, I want to think of this from an existential perspective for a second, because like the construct of God, I think, you know, evolved for to serve a function, a good psychological function. You know, humans seem to have this deep need for a higher meaning or a sort of higher personal meaning for their lives, and to think that there's a reason for all this that we're going through, you know, that all the suffering as well as the joys. Do you think that like there's any sort of, I'm asking both of you, do you think there's any sort of scientific finding, even if like the microtubules hypothesis is correct, that can speak or give hope to those existential concerns that humans have?
I think that links nicely to Michael's last point in a way, that, you know, you might think the best explanation to fine-tuning is some kind of intelligent design or value involved in shaping the universe. I mean, an interesting case, Nagel, who we started off talking about, his 2012 book that got really a lot of very critical reviews. He takes the fine tuning and other things very seriously, but he doesn't believe in God. He believes that the universe has some kind of inherent teleology or direction. So it's not obvious just because we need, even if we do need to postulate something like that, and I'm not saying we do, it's not obvious that it would, you know, satisfy our religious impulses, right, or the kind of God we're looking for. Can I say a couple of things about the multiverse
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. But yeah, so I'm just really stimulated by these kind of... So Michael's right that there is speculative support for some kind of multiverse. But one crucial point that often gets over... So two points, though, two problems. One crucial point that often gets overlooked is that what you don't get from the physics is any grounds for thinking these different universes have different laws, right? That doesn't come out of the physics. And that's what you need in order to explain the fine-tuning, because the idea is there's all these different universes and that the relevant parameters in physics, you know, they have all different values, so it becomes statistically inevitable that you'll have a fine-tuned universe. But actually, you can't get that out of the physics, so you need to go a little bit beyond the physics to explain the fine-tuning. But the other point is, there is this big problem in the contemporary multiverse theory called the Boltzmann brain problem. I don't know how much we want to go. I mean, just to put the essence, I think of it, and I think physicists think of it as, it's kind of a false prediction of the theory. The standard, according to the most scientifically supported version of the multiverse, highly ordered universes like ours are incredibly rare, unbelievably rare. Even among the subset of universes with observers in, highly ordered universes are incredibly rare. In fact, so this is from Roger Penrose, demonstrated that the most common kind of observer in the multiverse are these Boltzmann brains, these brains that just spontaneously come into being out of chaos and then go back into the void. So even amongst the set of universes with observers, our universe is highly unusual. And most physicists take that to be a disconfirmation of the standard multiverse. Or, you know, maybe the theory can be tinkered with, but it's, as it stands, it's a strong prediction problem. So I sort of think actually both God and the multiverse have false predictions. Like I think of the problem of evil as kind of a false prediction, because you think that the God hypothesis predicts that there'd be a much better world than we in fact have. So that's a kind of disconfirmation. The multiverse theory has this Boltzmann brain. So again, I think they're kind of tied. Oh. You
know, but even if there is some sort of a designer or tinker that set the dials, in a way, the counter to that is, the universe isn't very finely tuned for life. Life can exist, and particularly conscious life, almost nowhere. It's very, very rare environments in which this could happen. And as far as we know so far, it's only happened once. Probably not the case. But in any case, it would certainly take, by the natural processes of origins of life and evolution, billions of years to get to sentience and consciousness. So if a designer did this, you know, why set it up where it takes, so the universe is 13.7 billion years old. Essentially, it takes, you know, what, 9 billion years to even get started. If there's some purpose to it or some design to it, it certainly seems wasteful that, you know, 99.9% of the universe is not finely tuned for life.
Absolutely.
And, you know, 99% of the time of the universe is, you know, was completely wasted. And then finally, in the last 2,000 years, Jesus comes and we're all saved. Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, I completely agree with Michael on that. I mean, I take that to be actually, in a sense, part of the problem of evil and part of the false prediction of upstairs. And but then there's the question is, well, is that a worse false prediction than the Boltzmann brain problem? And we've got it. I mean, I think most physicists say with the multiverse hypothesis, we're going to have to tinker with it to get rid of this Boltzmann brain problem. Mm. What a theist could say, I'm not a theist, I'm an agnostic, but what a theist could say is, well, let's tinker with the theistic hypothesis. So John Stuart Mill answered these kind of problems Michael's raising and the more general problem of evil by saying, well, God isn't all powerful. Maybe God has limited power. So maybe, you know, the best expert, you look to the fine tuning and you explain the evil and suffering, the emptiness of the universe in terms of the limited powers of God. The problem, you know, a lot of dogmatic believers, the problem, you know, don't want to tinker with hypothesis. So that's one problem. So as I see it, you know, I think the fine tuning is a real problem. There are two explanations that both have pretty serious false predictions, but maybe they can be tinkered with so that they get around these predictions. I don't know. I think it's an interesting open question, but I don't think we should. I guess things are so polarized now, right? You've got either side not wanting to give any ground, you know, and I think this is because people like the comfort of certainty. You know, the atheists want to think, you know, the religious people are sort of backward fools because that gives you a kind of certainty, comfort of the theists want to think the atheists are sort of in denial. But, you know, I think we need to face up to the fact that, you know, there's a lot less certainty in these matters. Libertarian free will, I think, is like than we ordinarily think. And certainly since the fine tuning, I think there's a real question here that we should think about. And it's very open.
You know, if the laws of nature have built into them some kind of teleology, which appears to be the case in the sense that you go from this kind of general gruel of an early universe where there's not much structure at all to what we have today, where there's a lot of structure. If you want to call that teleology, well, that's true. And that's the result of the laws of nature, where you end up with these emergent properties that lead to more complex systems. You know, Gould used to make this point that in terms of like a purpose-driven universe, well, if you're at the left wall of simplicity, you can only go to the right and become more complex if you're going to do anything at all. So if you want to call that, you know, sort of a purposeful universe, fine, but that isn't what most people mean by God. Right. You know, they really anthropomorphize it. There's this agent out there, an advanced, super powerful agent. So again, what's the difference between that and a super advanced extraterrestrial intelligence that can genetically engineer organisms and create solar systems and even cause stars to collapse into black holes in the singularity they create a new universe? Mm-hmm. Well, any entity that create universes in life is God.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what Nagel means by teleology, he takes it to be a basic law of nature. There's some teleological laws, part of the basic laws of nature. So I think that is going beyond, you know, the standard scientific picture or, you know, I mean, the theistic hypothesis I was entering with that there is some kind of actual designer. So I think that would be going beyond.
You know, Freeman Dyson has this line in one of his books that drives atheists crazy, where it's almost as if the universe knew we were coming. And it's like, and I'm pretty sure he's, I don't know if he's an atheist or but an agnostic or something. And of course, Christians glom onto that. You see, even the physicist, the great Freeman Dyson says, the universe knew we were coming. Or Stephen Hawking says, then we'll know the mind of God. Oh, stop using those words.
So could we wrap up here? Basically, we all know where Michael stands on these three things because he wrote the article and that was the inspiration for this chat today. Maybe we'll go, let me just say really quickly what I think.
Yeah,
really quickly.
Yeah, I've been dying to know what you think about it. Come on, what's your stake a claim here?
Well, you know, I'm going to, you know, I kind of like the spirit of possibility and openness that someday there will be a discovery. So I'm inclined to not say either of the three are final mysteries and to say, and I sort of have this belief that all will be revealed. Now, maybe we won't be conscious to know what was revealed, but I just feel like if humanity, and this might be a big if, but if humanity can last long enough and we can kind of advance our scientific technologies to a certain degree that is unimaginable today, which I think will be possible, you know, if we could fast forward like 2000 years from now, I sort of have this intuition that all will be revealed and that we'll be like, oh shit, like that's what it was. You know, that's just my intuition. So what's your conclusion there, Philip, on these three?
Well, I think I share your hope. I think on consciousness is, you know, my main area of work. I think there is a positive research program that really, you know, could make work and is already starting to make progress. And I think, you know, we're held back by a sort of dogmatic attachment to materialism, not too unsimilar to the dogmatism that Copernicus and Galileo faced. And I mean, I'm not comparing myself to this was the views of Russell and Eddington. So I think there is a real positive proposal there that might work out. It might not work out. It might work out and we should give it a chance. Free will, I think we just don't know enough about the brain yet. And we think we know more about the brain. And it is an empirical question. Ultimately, we will know enough about the brain to know whether free will is an illusion, and it might be. But I just don't think we're anywhere near knowing, you know, that kind of detail about the hugely complex system that is the brain. And on God, I think before the 1970s, you should be an atheist. You know, there was no sign of God in physics. And I think that's still with us because for 200 years, it just looked like God had been ruled out. But I think the surprising discovery, the fine tuning, I think that when you dispassionately think about that, I think that, you know, there is some force to that argument. But there's another explanation. And so, I think we have to wait. I hope that this will be resolved. Maybe, as Michael said, maybe the fine-tuning problem will go away as physics develops. Maybe we'll get more confirmation for the right kind of multiverse, and then God will become ruled out again. But at the moment, I think we the dispassionate, unbiased thinker ought to be sort of 50-50 on the matter.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you guys so much for this chat. And thank you, Michael, for writing that article to spur this conversation in the first place.
Oh, you're welcome. This is great. Thanks for hosting this. It's really good. A good conversation. This is how we advance knowledge.
It was great fun.
It's great chatting.
And anyone that wants to weigh in on these heavy topics, please weigh in the comments section. Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.
Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.